Welcome to the third installment of the special Advent series of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast, which of course means you can go over to 1517.org/podcast and see all the other things that we got going on over there. Eric, today we are joined by author of 1 million books, and I have read, I think, most of these books. My favorite of the 1 million books, I think, is The Imperfect Disciple.
I have it on my shelf, and I love it as well.
I think that probably says something about me, but it's still, it's a good one. You should read it. He also is also a contributor to the Sinner Saint devotional that me and you also contributed to, that 1517 put out, which, by the way, if you know an imperfect disciple and that just can't get their devotional life in check, this maybe for Christmas, that's what you do. You get them the Sinner Saint devotional and help them out. You know,
Dan, your seamless transition there was incredible.
I've got very few gifts. The transition gift on the podcast is one of them. So that man is Jared C. Wilson. What's up, Jared?
Guys, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. So what do you do? Just so for maybe there's some people that don't know who you are. I mean, well, let me, before you say what you do.
Yeah.
Because you're served as a pastor, you're an author, you do some teaching, you do some writing, blogging. The most important thing he does is he's going to be at Here We Still Stand in October. and this is important because there's not that many tickets left. There's like 75% sold out, and the price of those tickets goes up after the first of the year, so you should probably buy yourself that Christmas present as well and get in on that. Otherwise, you won't be able to hear author of 1 million books, Jared C. Wilson, talk. And what's interesting about the conference is that we are sort of theming the conference where it's themed around the common faith, which is based off the Apostles' Creed, and we're going to be jumping off into various topics around those articles. Oddly enough, Jared, the Apostles' Creed got some run in mainstream publications over the last couple of weeks. Which, I mean, you don't see the Apostles' Creed getting in the mainstream press too much.
No, it was interesting too, because I think like the response was pretty revealing about people's understanding of evangelical tribes even just Protestantism in general, because there are some people saying like, "Oh, we don't do the creed. We're not Catholic," or
yeah,
you know, or whatever. So that's just for Catholics, what have you. It shows just how, you know, narrow their understanding of evangelicals or Protestants.
Yeah, I wasn't overly concerned that the president didn't recite the creed.
I wasn't either, and I'm a big Trump critic. Like, no one's ever accused me of being a fan of the president, but to me, it was like almost a non-story.
Yeah, I was like, oh, like, you know, his. You know, devotion to the church is, you know, up for debate. But
I thought he wasn't a believer.
Yeah, so, it's
he would with, you know, refrain, to me, just was in keeping with what I already believe about him. So
sure.
Upset about it or anything.
Yeah, what was very unnerving was a couple of Protestant pastors and then just general laity. Their response, like, well, I wouldn't recite that either, and you're like, whoa, what? Like, or like, I'm a born again Christian. I would never dabble in such a thing. And you're like, wait a minute. I don't know if I want to go this far, but sort of the point of this creed is to figure out if you're a born again Christian or not. That's the whole. It's sort of the lowest bar. Like Jared's Baptist. I'm a Lutheran. I got Catholic friends and Presbyterian friends, and they're all down. Like, you're supposed to be down. It is the common faith. It is the very basics of the Christian faith.
The non-confessional heritage that modern evangelicals have inherited, right? So you don't understand even the dictionary definition of the word Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see the little c Catholic in the creed, you don't immediately think of what it means in the creed. You just, well, I'm not Catholic, therefore.
Yeah. You know,
yeah, and I think there's a little bit of a pushback to this sort of and I know this does not have anything to do with Christmas or what we're talking about, but hey, you know, the birth of Christ is in the creed. So, but I think it has to do with sort of this, like, oh, I don't want this intellectual, rote, ritualistic sort of Christian. We in modern evangelicalism, it is all sort of subjective and passionate and emotion based, and so, like, I don't need to just recite these words and check these boxes. Like, that's dead. You know, I remember growing up, there was a thing called dead orthodoxy. And I'm not saying that that's not a thing, but I think that what we end up putting in that container are sometimes things that we ought not put in that container. We're like, well, actually, I think that, I think like the creed, that's still useful. That would be worth hanging on to.
Right. Well, and the same people that say that sing the same songs every week. So, you know, it's not repetition that they're afraid of, I don't think.
Exactly. Yeah, everybody's got a liturgy. Everybody's got a liturgy, man.
It's true. You know,
that's the way it is.
All right, enough about that. Jared, so tell us a little bit about yourself and then what passage you have picked for me and Eric to explain to you.
Yeah, well, I write books 23 hours a day.
Right.
When I'm not podcasting. I work at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, currently work in the communications department. I oversee anything having to do with text. I'm a writer-editor, essentially, for the seminary. Although next year I'll be transitioning to a faculty role, so I'll be coming out of this office and teaching mainly in pastoral ministry classes and things related to ministry. And I also direct a residency program at my church, Liberty Baptist Church. It's called the Pastoral Training Center, 18-month program where we just try to complement theological education with more sort of pastoral sensibility stuff, spiritual formation, discipleship. How to be a normal, as normal as possible person and not a socially awkward seminary geek.
The world is in dire need of such training, Jared.
That's right. Can we get you out of here at least as normal as possible? That's kind of what I do there. I got some great guys. They love Jesus. They love the church. And that's one of the highlights of my life, what I get to do. I'm married. My wife Becky and I have been married for 22 years. We have two teenage daughters. And so I have chosen the genealogy of Jesus from Matthew's gospel, which is found in Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 16.
Great. Well, I hope these guys that you're working with love Jesus, love the church, and affirm the creed.
They do, actually.
Okay, that's great. Yeah. All right, man. Well, you have chose the text. It is on you to do the reading.
Okay, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, and Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab, and Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam the father of Abijah, and Abijah the father of Asaph, and Asaph the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat, the father of Joram, and Joram, the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah, the father of Jotham, and Jotham, the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh, the father of Amos, and Amos, the father of Josiah, and Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel, and Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel, the father of Abiad, and Abiad, the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim, the father of Azor, and Azor, the father of Zadok, and Zadok, the father of Achim, and Achim, the father of Eliad, and Eliad, the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar, the father of Mathan, and Mathan, the father of Jacob, Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who was called Christ.
Well, let me just say two things before we continue. Number one, you nailed that reading, man. Way to go. Congratulations on that. Yeah.
This text, man.
And the second thing is thanks for drawing our attention to the parts of the Bible that we usually skip over, if we're honest, right?
That's right.
The genealogies. I mean, the average reader, let's just be real. We come to a genealogy, we're like, well, there's a bunch of names, and I'm not really sure what to do with them, so we'll just move on.
That's right.
Well, so what's significant about this?
Well, it's significant for a few reasons. First of all, we see just this long generational saga, right? So if you're looking through just the length, the breadth, the depth of the Old Testament, and you're just wondering, what's all this got to do with what I find from Matthew onward, right? You know, there's even some you know, push today. We got Andy Stanley and others saying we got to unhitch the Old Testament. And depending on what's meant by that, maybe there's some, you know, seeds of truth in it in terms of what's binding or not binding and all that, you know, sort of thing. But the idea that it's really disconnected, or that we ought to disconnect it, is undercut, not just in this genealogy from Matthew, but I mean, throughout the New Testament. But something like this tells us, first of all, that God is a promise keeper, and every little narrative, every unknown, what we might would consider in the scope of history, insignificant person or story in their kind of run-of-the-mill life. Some of these are just names, right? We don't even know what their backstories are, except that here we see Matthew helping us to see that the Lord is orchestrating sovereignly all of these little stories and you know, little people, all the way to bring about the incarnation of the Anointed One, of the Messiah Jesus. So if you think, if you just ever think for a moment, just as a devotional application, that your life has no meaning or what have you, you can see kind of one takeaway is that the Lord is always doing something bigger than we can see. And he's always bringing things back to the magnification of Christ. So that's one thing we see in the genealogy.
And also it's evidence that sometimes God works very slowly.
Yes.
I mean, this takes a while.
It takes a while just to read it.
Yeah, right. It takes a while to read it. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have 14 generations, and then you have 14 generations, you know, this sort of thing. So, I mean, you have a lot of, so God makes a promise.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you can back this all the way up to Eve in the garden, right? He makes a promise to her. Then he calls out this dude, Abraham, and he's going to bring about the fulfillment of that promise to overcome death and sin. And he calls out this guy Abraham, and then it is a while. It is a long road. And one of the things that is striking about this list, there might be some names that you're like, oh, I know that name, but they're probably names that also you know that wasn't a great person. That person is not all that righteous. You know, this kind of thing. And yeah,
there's a lot of sinners populating this list.
Yes, it's a very there's. All sinners, just only sinners on this list, and some notoriously so. But what you also see is God even working through that. I mean, there's some like really bad stuff in here where you see God actually working all things together for the ultimate good of the fulfillment of his promise, his good word that he has given us. You see that going on, and I think if God working all things together for good means anything, which I think it does mean something, it means that God takes bad things and works them together for good, because it doesn't make any sense to say God works good things together for good. And you're like, well, that's useful. Thanks. It's good to know. Yeah. But no, it's saying that there's things that don't seem good at all. And he's like, no, I'm at work here. And there is some relationships in this genealogy that speak to that, so that it's one thing to say that Jesus is like the son of Abraham. It's you can say he's the son of David, son of Mary, son of God. He's also the son of whoredom and Gentiles and adultery and all of this too. He's the son of all those things.
Yeah. Well, and you know what's notable also, apart from just the generational sagas here and the sin that's a part of this long winding story, is you know, Matthew's gospel is it's exceptionally Jewish,
right?
And the genealogy would be, you know, this genealogy in particular would be somewhat maybe shocking is the word, but at least surprising to the Jewish reader, because typically you wouldn't include women in the genealogy. So right.
Especially not these women.
Well, and that's the thing, right? So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 women named, which in itself is innovative, and I think speaks to you know, the larger understanding of how the gospel elevates women in a culture when they were considered just slightly higher than dogs, right? So you have the inclusion of women, which is not customary, and then you have these particular women out of all the moms and grandmas he could have put in there. If we just go through, right? So Tamar, who you know, played the harlot and tricked Judah, Rahab, the prostitute, Ruth, the Moabite, right, who's not even supposed to be allowed, into, the Jewish fold. Uriah's wife, right, that's Bathsheba, who, depending on how you look at it, some consider an adulteress, more than likely just sexually exploited, right, mm-hmm. taken advantage of by the mm-hmm. king. And then to finish with Mary, who, is an ordinary sinner, but because of this sort of question of her conception and relationship with Joseph, there's maybe this sort of shadow of, questionable pregnancy there type of thing. I mean, we know everything is above board. She was a virgin when Joseph married her and that sort of thing. But there's still just that, every woman on the list has this kind of, question mark over them culturally, religiously, or what have you, for some even ethnically. And Matthew picks those women to show us just how redemptive the coming of the King Christ is.
Yeah, it's a fairly scandalous list, and it is interesting to think that when God decides to use Mary, the very announcement, I mean, before he's actually born, as Mary's having to be pregnant, before he's drawing a breath, there's the rumors are going, the scandal level is risen, right? I mean, he is before even birth. It was incorrect to even say he's born into this scandal and into rumors. I mean, he's conceived in it, that people are talking, and this lineage then lines up with that as well. Like, well, I don't know, this guy's got questionable
background.
Yeah. Yeah.
This reminds me of, we had Elise Fitzpatrick on the show last week, Jared, and she we talked quite a bit about the subversive nature of the gospel, and especially in regard to women, and in the Christmas story, you see this. But this is just another example of that, where Matthew really does elevate women that especially no one would want to elevate. I mean, it's one thing to elevate, like you're saying, the ordinary or somebody that seems above board. But he particularly picks out ones that have all sorts of problems, which is just a testament to the fact that this is ultimately a story of grace.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, this is intentional. Like we said, he could have named, any grandmom in the list, but he chose these grandmoms on purpose. And the fact that they all have this sort of, shadow of speculation. Some of them, purely innocently, it's just, hopefully they're on the outs or what have you. But the fact that he chose them to highlight tells us really that the story of Christ is a story of grace, is a story of redemption. And, for me, when I look at, the list and consider that, it's just a reminder to me that, nobody's too far gone to be reached by Jesus. Nobody's story is too broken to, to be fixed by Jesus. Nobody's past is too dark or scandalous or whatever, that Jesus cannot bring grace and comfort and the embrace of his redemptive love to them.
Yeah, and you even look at the list if you move over to the list of men here, it's not like you have a bunch of upstanding individuals on that side of the ledger. I mean, you've got David, who, we love the verse that talks about him being a man after God's own heart, but who is the exploiter of the wife of Uriah, and who is the one who murders or figures out a way to basically murder Uriah, who indeed God is faithful to, and God, stays faithful to. And he's one of those great examples. But you look even at the names that aren't as well known, and you got a lot of messy dudes in there.
Yeah. Well, and just the larger picture is there's something about the gospel narrative. It's not untrue, but it's like this revisionist history, right? Where you see how these names are listed as like this proud lineage, right? I mean, they're included here. Like, let's celebrate what God has done in bringing Christ through this line. And it reminds me of things like, even just seeing the story of Abraham and all the times that he doubted or tried to take things into his own hands or whatever it was, or exploited, put his wife in danger. And then you come to the New Testament and he's, spoken of with such reverence. And it's not that they didn't know what a big sinner he was, but it's that revisionist history of the gospel that, you see what the Lord was doing through him was meant to magnify God's grace, or even Sarah, right? So the Apostle Peter saying to women, you're Sarah's children if you don't fear anything that's frightening. And I'm like, I mean, Sarah was afraid all the time. I mean, she was kind of a jerk in her own right. So it's not, and it's not as if Peter didn't know that. So for him to say that is just the way the Lord sees us through the lens of his grace is this kind of revisionist history. It's not lying about our sinful state, but it's saying that the most defining thing about us is what God is doing in us and for us.
I think that when you have this sort of thing, I mean, in the incarnation, you have God uniting himself to humanity. He's assembling to himself DNA and this sort of thing. He's come to assume sin. I mean, this is the mission, that I'm going to take on the sin of the world, right? This is his title. When he walks up to enter ministry, John says, behold the Lamb of God, and here's the main thing that's going on here, who takes away the sin of the world. That's what he's here for. Yeah. He's here for sin. And so even in his the line that he comes from, in his genealogy, he's here to assume all this sin. This is part of what he's doing. Like, all of this sin that's represented here, it's now it belongs to me.
Yeah.
I'm the one who comes to assume all that to myself. There is an interesting post that we posted earlier this week by actually one of Eric's elders wrote, but he wrote a post called I Am the Reason for the Season, and starts out by apologizing for his role in making the incarnation necessary. Which is a great post, but you know, we say Jesus is the reason for the season, and that would be the reason that we celebrate, and true enough. But you and I are the reason, and this list is the reason that the incarnation is necessary.
Yeah.
We are the reason. Our sin is the reason, and he's here for that. He's here to take away the sin of the world, and to gift his righteousness to the world and to save the world. It's great.
I love that phrase, Jared, the revisionist history of the gospel. That's really, really good. And one of the great examples of that, which is not in the lineage here, but I can't help but think about it every time when I think about this sort of thing. When Peter in 2 Peter 2 refers to Lot as, quote, righteous Lot.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
You're like, that is the most revisionist thing I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. And those guys knew the stories better than we do. So
that's right. So that's incredibly helpful for a sinner like me, man.
And it's not like, to understand the gospel is to know that he's not whitewashing anything, because you might would think that. And to look at even this genealogy, if you don't know the glory of Christ in the good news of Christ, you have all these names, you have this wealth of sin, and it ends with this, of whom Jesus was born, who was called Christ. And you would think that just the sheer weight of the sin and darkness would overshadow that name at the end. But when you really know that name at the end, you know that his light casts back over all of these names, all of the, you know, the sheer gravity of their unrighteousness. And it just reminds me of Paul in 2 Corinthians 3 talking about what begins with, like, the glory of the law, but then to say that the glory of Christ is much more glorious. You know, the law is glory, but the gospel is more glorious still.
Mm. Yeah, I actually had this conversation a while back where a guy was talking to me about law and gospel, and he said, you make it sound like the gospel is better than the law. And I was like, well, it is. And
well,
he's
yeah.
Like, and he's
it's
like,
more
he's,
glorious.
And he's like, I don't know if it's, wouldn't you say that they're both good? I'm like, well, yeah, they're both. Yeah, I'm not saying the law. That's somebody saying the law is bad.
Yeah.
But if you ask me if the gospel is better, the answer is yes. And that's not my idea. Paul agrees it's not just better. It's greater, more glorious. It's in every way, it eclipses everything else. I mean, like, it is where we see the glory of God most clearly is in the message of the gospel.
Yeah, I always say the law's not bad. It's just bad at doing what it's not designed to do.
Mm-hmm. Which is what we try to make it do most of the time.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's our problem. We use the tool improperly. Tool's fine. We just use it badly.
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jared, we've been doing this thing where every time we have someone on for these Advent episodes, we end with this. What is, and you might say, like, none, I hate them all, but what is your favorite Christmas hymn or Christmas carol?
Oh my word.
Yeah, no prep. See, this is how you get an honest answer. You can't. You just have to like on the spot.
For years, my favorite was "Hark the Herald Angels," mainly because of that "God and Sinner Reconciled" line.
Yeah, there's just something so good. About
just getting to that line. I mean, the rest of the thing is good, but there's just something about "God and Sinner Reconciled" that just I love that. But I've become pretty fond of "O Holy Night."
Which
if you'd asked me 2 years ago, I wouldn't have said that.
I love "O Holy Night."
Yeah,
but Dan is not a fan. He's not a fan of "O Holy Night," but I love "O Holy." I'm with you, man.
No, okay. It's not. I said I'm not like I don't hate "O Holy Night." I don't hate it.
Yeah,
I'm backing you into a corner.
Yes. Hey, you know, because what this means is I got to go find a version of "O Holy Night" to put at the end of the podcast. It's gonna be great.
Yeah.
You know, it's just no "O Come, O Come, Emmanuel." That's all.
Well, you know what's underrated is "God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen." That's an underrated.
Yeah.
That's a great tune.
Yeah, yeah. I like if you listen to the whole thing, and like I would recommend the version, modern version with Bare Naked Ladies and Sarah McLachlan. I don't know if you've heard that.
No.
Check it out, Bare Naked Ladies and Sarah McLachlan.
I have heard it.
It's excellent. It's excellent.
Yes.
Yeah.
It came out a while ago, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
When both those.
There's a lot of
both...
gospel in it. You don't think that, but there's a lot of gospel in it.
Now this is gonna have like a different rating because we keep saying this phrase over and over. That's just the name of a band, guys.
Canadian band.
It's not like a girl group that's gone wild. Nothing or anything. Weird. But I'm a huge early Bare Naked Ladies fan.
Okay.
Yeah.
With the chickadee strata, the Chinese chicken, and all that.
No,
stuff?
Before that, the first three records are amazing.
Okay. So,
just so
I just know their radio hits. I couldn't listen to them because I was Baptist and their name, you know.
The name wasn't it's funny. They don't even like have like offensive thing. This is a true story. The reason the band is named Bare Naked Ladies is because they figured out that when they were just forming the band and they were doing their first shows, on the flyers they could put live Bare Naked Ladies, and it actually worked, and like a ton of guys came out to the show.
Yeah, but then they're angry that these fat Canadians walked up on
the They probably were, but if you're like, we're so good that if we can just get them here, and then well, they had a band they were friends with that decided that they would try to do the same thing. And so they changed their name to Free Beer, and that was the name of their band. So, like, if they're doing shows together, it's Bare Naked Ladies and Free Beer.
I heard their Christmas song, so I can't speak for Free Beer, but
and as you know, we're gonna
listen to them.
We are going to outro from this moment, this profound discussion about Bare Naked Ladies, right into "O Holy Night."
Oh, that's
this is going to be great.
Well, Jared, thanks for coming on and having the conversation with us, guys. If you want to hear Jared talk about, we gave Jared a 90-mile-an-hour fastball right down the middle of the plate for "Here We Still Stand," which is the death and resurrection of Christ. So he should be able to say something about that.
I believe in that. That's good. That's
yeah,
good
he that confesses that to be true. And if you want to come hear him and hang out with me and Eric, you should do that. You can go over to herewestillstand.org. Those tickets are almost gone, so do it before the first of the year. Jared, have a really Merry Christmas, man.
I'll do my best. Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks, Jared. Merry Christmas.
See you guys.
The stars are brightly shining. It is the night of our dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. A thrill of hope, the weary soul rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Fall on your knees, oh, hear the angel. Oh my, when Christ was born.